You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
So, hello, this is Glenn Lowry at bloggingheads.tv and Brown University here at the Glenn Show. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Professor William A. Darity Jr., known to all of his friends as Sandy, Sandy Darity, who is the Samuel Du Bois Cook Professor of Public Policy, African and African-American Studies and Economics at Duke University, and who directs the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke. And Sandy, it's really a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. It's we go way back.
I was just about to tell our viewers that I first met Brother Sandy Darity in 1974. Sandy, 1974, man.
Yeah, yeah.
We were graduate students at MIT together. Sandy showed up. He already had a master's from the London School of Economics.
No, I didn't. I never got a master's degree.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, but you had spent a year at the LSE.
I spent too much time in the clubs in London.
Oh, man. And that's where you learned about Joan Robinson and Luigi Passanetti and all that?
That's true. But it wasn't what I should have been studying there.
Sandy is one of the leading economists in the country. I think I can say that. A student of inequality, of capital theory in his early days, of social inequalities of all sorts, of race and discrimination and so on. And I've invited you on, Sandy, to talk about your most recent work on wealth disparities in the United States. You and a team of scholars, and I'll let you describe this in greater detail, have been producing a series of reports of very well-documented empirical assessments of wealth disparities and the implications of that for American economic health and for equity and social justice. And I just thought it would be a great thing to have you talk some about that and see what we can learn from what you've been doing.
So we have a project that's been funded primarily by the Ford Foundation called the National Asset Scorecard for Communities of Color. And what motivated this project was the perception on the part of a program officer who was our initial angel at Ford, named Kilolo Kijikazi, her perception that there was a need for information about the net worth position of specific national origin groups rather than relying upon the conventional aggregate categories that we typically use for race and ethnic classification in the United States. So instead of exclusively having information about Hispanics or Asians or Blacks, we were charged with trying to gain information about more specifically Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, or Filipinos, Chinese, or Japanese Americans, or among the Black community, more specifically Blacks of recent immigrant status from either the Caribbean or from the African continent, in contrast with Blacks who are descendants of folks who were enslaved in the United States. And we also asked white respondents for their information about their ethnic origin or ancestry. So we also have the capability of looking at those kinds of differences as well, but we haven't explored them as intensively as we've looked at some of the other differences within these gross categories. So okay, that was the charge. And in the process, we've generated a series of reports, some that are still using the traditional aggregates, but others that use our city-level data from the five cities where we conducted these surveys, which we selected because of the fact that those were cities that would enable us to look at very specific national origin groups.
Okay, I want to zero in, if I may, on the sources of the data. Because it sounds like you guys are doing something unique here, something that hadn't been done before, in terms of comprehensive surveys of urban populations, asking people about their asset holdings. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm just trying to understand what you've
got. That's exactly right. And if there's any survey that maybe is somewhat comparable, although it did not have the same emphasis on net worth. It's the multi-city study of urban inequality. But this is quite unique in terms of our focus on assets and debts. And the five cities that we surveyed initially are Boston, Miami, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles. And we've also done a supplementary survey in Los Angeles, which is a series of face-to-face interviews rather than phone interviews, which enabled us to get information about the phenotypical characteristics of the respondents. And so that's another potential project that we're going to try to explore.
Again, I think for our viewers' sake, I'm going to need to translate. You're talking about, you might know a person is Hispanic or you might know they're Black, but you don't know what their skin tone is, and that could be important.
Right. We also actually had our interviewers in that particular study code whether or not they thought the individual was attractive looking.
Oh, my.
And we asked the respondents if we could take their photograph, and about half of the 500 respondents agreed to let us do that. So we actually can compare what the interviewers described about the respondent against actual photographs of their images.
Okay, that's all very interesting. I want to get down into some of these details, but first, if I may, I'd just like to ask you, you know, some sort of basic motivating question. So wealth, not income, and national origin groups.
Yeah.
I'm interested in both. I mean, why is it important to attempt to assay the wealth holding disparities of different national origin groups? What does that teach us about the nature of inequality, so forth?
Well, we do know that typically across the more aggregate categories that we're accustomed to using, we find sharp differences in net worth. We find that in existing surveys that have been taken by a number of sources, including the Fed's Survey of Consumer Finances. We also find this to be true in the Survey of Income and Program Participation. And consistently, there are these huge disparities between, say, Blacks and whites in those surveys. And these disparities are startlingly enormous. They far exceed any other kinds of measured economic disparities, including, for example, income disparities. They're just absolutely staggering. But in most of those data sets, we don't really have the capacity to examine other groups like Asian Americans in sufficient numbers to make any strong claims. And moreover, to the extent that those studies do allow us to do that at all, we only are capable of doing it by looking at these very gross categories that tend to homogenize very disparate populations or communities. And so if we were to look at the Hispanic community, for example, there are substantial differences in the economic position of, say, folks who are of Cuban origin versus Puerto Rican origin versus Mexican origin.
Sure.
And if we just look at Hispanics collectively, what we're ultimately looking at in U.S. data is typically the characteristics of the Mexican-American population.
Sure.
Because they're so prevalent in the data. But that's not an accurate tracking of the experiences of all communities of Hispanics in the United States. And similarly, if we were to look at Asian Americans who have been labeled a model minority because of their apparent economic success in the United States, that doesn't apply to all national origin communities within the Asian category. So that there would be very sharp differences between how the Cambodian community looks versus, say, the East Indian community.
But, you know, that doesn't surprise me, and it makes me want to ask whether or not Asianness or Latino Hispanicness, or for that matter, Blackness, is in and of itself a particularly interesting categorization, relative to, I don't know what, the amount of human capital that people's ancestors might have had, the education levels, the extent of entrepreneurship, things like that. I'm not claiming any expertise on this subject. I'm just saying the observation, for example, amongst whites. I mean, I would expect Jews would probably look different from Italian or Irish Americans if you were able to make any such assessments, who might look different from Appalachian, Scotch-Irish, or whatever. I'm making this up as I go along. But you see what I'm getting at. Whiteness per se wouldn't necessarily tell me that much. Likewise, I shouldn't have thought Asianness or Hispanicness would tell me that much.
And I think that's a great point. I roughly agree. I'm going to say roughly.
That's because, about all I can expect, Sandy. I'll take it.
I roughly agree. I mean, because I think there is a serious critical question that can be raised about these politically convenient categories that have been constructed that arise in the census and that are used in the policy context and in public discourse. I mean, do they really mean anything? Is there any reasonable basis for clustering folks who are from South Asia or the South Asian subcontinent with folks who are from Vietnam? Probably not, really, when you come down to it. And so Asianness per se may not have much meaning. And so I think that that's a very worthwhile question. And I think the work that we're doing, which actually separates or sorts between the various national origin groups, is a route towards challenging the conventional kinds of constructions of these racial or ethnic groups.
Okay, well, let's delve a little bit into what you're actually finding. Maybe by just first a broad description, you said staggering disparities. What are we talking about?
So if we looked at the city of Boston in particular, one of the sites that we've surveyed, the median net worth for the average white household is in excess of $250,000. And the median net worth for black households, specifically those black households that we refer to as American descendant households, is $8. Not 80, not 800, but $8. So if you think about the order of magnitude of those disparities just in the city of Boston, that's astronomical. And it far overshadows virtually any other kind of disparity that we would measure off in terms of economic well-being.
Well, in view of the fact that this may be a nitpicking point, and say so if you think so, in view of the fact that I assume there got to be a lot of zeros or even negative numbers for people's net wealth, some people will not have a positive net wealth. I'm just wondering what I learned from looking at the ratio of medians. I mean, I'm not saying there's not a significant disparity between two populations. Half of one has $200,000 of wealth and half of the other basically has no wealth at all. I'm not saying there's no difference. There is a difference there, certainly. Yeah. But it would be inappropriate, wouldn't it? I'm asking you, really, to take the ratio of the median of one to the other as a measure of the gap. When, like I say, I mean, that ratio could in principle be infinite if half of the people were net debtors, you know.
Yeah.
What am I trying to capture in that measurement? Yeah.
Okay. What really is ultimately at stake is the question, I think, of whether or not we can close these gaps through different decisions, different behavior on the part of the group that has the much lower level of wealth. And when you're looking at disparities of that order of magnitude, there's probably no feasible rate of savings that blacks in Boston could pursue that would enable them to autonomously or independently close that gap. So the magnitude of the gap is important information in terms of gauging what might have to be done if one wants to close the gap.
Why should I want to close the gap? And again, I ask this with trepidation because I'm not unfriendly to the idea of racial equality, but there are many gaps. Okay, why would, say I got income parity, say I got schooling parity, I might grant the point that over time it would take many, many, many generations in order for the wealth gap to close. But if I had income parity and if I had schooling parity and penetration of the occupational, professional occupations and things of that kind at something close to parity, why should I
There are two different issues. One is whether or not, in fact, closing these other gaps would lead to wealth parity.
Well, it's a very, very, very long run.
Well, I might even be skeptical about that, especially given your own initial research demonstrated that if you open up an initial gap, not in wealth, but in income, you won't necessarily close that gap, even if you have significant improvements in the human capital of the outgroup.
That's true. Let me just add, as long as social segregation of neighborhoods and social networks persisted.
Right. Discriminatory conditions of some sort. Yeah.
Yeah. Not necessarily employment discrimination, but discrimination in social networks.
So with respect to wealth, though, mm-hmm. it doesn't even require that, because the big issue is what are the transmissions and transfers of resources across generations. And to the extent that there is that disparity and it's not necessarily corrected in any way or adjusted or taken into account, that could go on indefinitely. Even if you close the gap in education or you close the gap in income, because the nexus between education and income is predicated on the view that people accumulate wealth via savings out of a higher level of income.
Yes.
But if the primary factor that's dictating wealth accumulation is intergenerational transfers, then it's not something that can be resolved or closed by having an improvement in education or other forms of human capital. Now, that said, the other question you're raising is why should we care so much about wealth gaps?
Yeah.
And my answer to that is that, and maybe we won't agree on this, but my answer to that is that wealth is the foremost indicator of economic well-being. It is an indicator of the capacity of households to meet emergencies when they're confronted with them, especially emergencies that might arise out of job loss or a major medical crisis in the household or family. It's a major source of the capability to provide young people in the family with high cachet education. It provides the capacity to purchase the ability to live in neighborhoods that have quality amenities. It performs so many. Well, I mean, it affects your capacity to participate in the political process, right? I mean, you know, if we really think about how the U.S. functions now, we could argue it's a plutocracy. And so to have even minimal engagement in a plutocratic political process requires you to have some measure of wealth. So,
well, I think the minimum wealth holding needed to get anybody to pay attention to you is way higher than 200 grand. But I take your point.
Yeah, we got to be in the $5 million zone something like that. Nevertheless. The opportunity to provide a comfortable life and a normal or at least a minimal range of opportunities for the next generation frequently is contingent on the wealth position of the household. The difficulty with income is that it's subject to being sporadic and unstable. And so the presence of a strong net worth position is, in fact, also an insurance policy against sharp fluctuations in income.
Okay, I've got a somewhat technical question here, and it's about what counts as wealth. And it's basically motivated by my sense that people have claims on transfers, like Social Security, for example, in virtue of their being in the society, in virtue of them paying the Social Security wage tax that they pay and things of this sort. Yeah. And while they can't lay claim to those assets in their bank account, they can count on those claims. I hope we can count on those claims being honored later. Yeah. So isn't even the person with no wealth, doesn't that person have something that is a little bit like wealth in the sense that they know that they will be able to get a flow of payments out of the government going forward, notwithstanding the fact that they can't lay their hands on it right now?
So we actually make a distinction between liquid assets and assets that have low levels of liquidity. And by liquid assets, as you know, we mean forms of assets that can be converted readily into cash and be used, which is what you would need to have access to, particularly in emergency situations.
Yes.
So we place resources like Social Security in the category of being a form of a pension, which is a form of wealth, but it's comparatively illiquid.
Okay.
Particularly for people who are below the age of below our age. Okay.
That's a lot of people.
So part of our study examines differences in access to liquid wealth. And at the national level, if you look at blacks and whites, we look at medians because they're relatively uncontaminated by extreme values. So that's why we look at the center of the distribution. I mean, if your numbers for means and medians are vastly different, although there are still substantial differences by race and ethnicity, but they look a whole lot different. Your mean values for blacks look substantially higher than their median values because they're pulled up by the folks who are at the upper tail of the distribution.
Yeah.
But so that's why we focus on medians, is because we think that that's giving us a sense of the more typical position of members of that group. But if you look at medians with respect to liquid assets at the national level, whites at the median have about $13,000 to $15,000 in liquid assets, and blacks have only $200 in liquid assets. And so very, very different kinds of situations in terms of access to resources that can be readily used in situations of crisis or emergency.
Okay, so here comes a question that you might expect from me. It's about whether race per se is important either as an assessment of the causes or as a assessment of the consequences of this disparity. Yeah. Presumably, low wealth is low wealth, right? I mean, if a person doesn't have liquid assets to draw on in an emergency, that person is disadvantaged, regardless of what group they belong to. Why wouldn't I be looking at this in terms of the overall population distribution of wealth holdings and calling attention to the difficulties that anybody with a relatively low holding of wealth might be confronting, regardless of what racial group they belong to?
Well, when we jump to the question of social policy, my inclination has been to emphasize programs that would address the asset poverty of all members of the U.S. population. But the distribution of asset poverty is quite different by race. And so, for example, if we were to look at the bottom quintile of income earners in the United States, the median white household in that bottom quintile of income earners has about $15,000 in net worth, while the median for blacks in that lowest quintile is approximately zero. And so, that's in that sense that I think we do have to pay attention to race, because the distributions of net worth are not equivalent across the two groups. And in fact, they're significantly lower for blacks virtually across the board. One of the most striking statistics, I think, that comes forward in our research is the fact that blacks with a college degree have $10,000 less in median net worth than whites who never finished high school. And so those kinds of disparities suggest to me that we are really ducking a serious dimension of wealth inequality when we don't talk about race. And I guess to some degree, that's been my critique of much of the work that people like Thomas Piketty, which I think has been very important work, have done, is that they're absolutely silent about ethnic and racial differences in access to wealth.
Okay, but I'm not sure you answered the question that I was asking. Maybe I didn't put it clearly. Okay. I get the descriptive point that there are racial differences and that they're substantial. And maybe your response in terms of policy, and we should get to that, covers this. But I had expected you to say something about social interactions between people within a common ethnic racial group or national origin group that somehow exacerbated, made worse the situation of any particular person. In other words, I can have a wealth of a given amount, but if I belong to a group where the average wealth holdings is low, then that disadvantages me in some way. And therefore, we should pay attention both to an individual distribution of individual wealth holding, but also to disparities amongst the groups themselves, because there's something causal that flows from the fact of the group disparities over and above simply counting the number of people in that group who have low wealth. Do you see what I'm getting at?
So, I mean, are
like,
you...
For example, neighborhoods where people don't have enough to keep their houses up will tend to go down. If I have a house in that neighborhood and the neighborhoods are segregated by race and I'm black, even if I have enough to pay my mortgage during an economic downturn or to fix my thing after a bad weather event, most of the people in my neighborhood don't. And therefore, the value of my property is undermined simply because I'm black living in a black neighborhood where most people don't have high wealth, something like that. That's maybe not a good example, but it's meant to illustrate what I'm getting at.
I certainly think that's an effect that can take place. It's not been something that I've thought about with the same degree of emphasis that you have. In the cliche language that we use in economics, you're really talking about externalities, I guess. Negative externalities that are associated with community characteristics. So if you have a community with depressed wealth, that can have adverse effects on members of that community whose wealth is less depressed. But one of the key points I want to make is that the thing that I keep emphasizing is the comparison across groups. And so the best off black folks still have less than white folks, substantially less than white folks with respect to groups that have shared levels of education, might even have shared levels of income, have shared levels of labor force participation, may have shared levels of occupational status. But when we look at their net worth position, they're vastly different. So even apart from the question of whether or not there's an adverse effect of members of my community generally having lower wealth, I will not have the same wealth that an individual who is part of the white community is likely to have, even if I have accomplished the same things or more.
Okay, so why is that?
That is because of the history of the way in which resources have been transferred across generations.
Is most of this wealth in the equity that people have in their homes? I'm asking. I have no idea, really.
I think for people who we identify as, or we tend to classify as middle class, yes, the most significant source of wealth is the equity in their homes. But when we start talking about people who are in a so-called upper middle class or higher, then we have to look at financial assets. That's what's really making a huge difference. And if we look at the complaints about the skewing of inequality in the United States or in other countries recently, if you're looking at it with respect to wealth, we have to pay close attention to what's happening with respect to the capacity of some people to own financial assets and to have marked rises in the values of those financial assets. The Great Recession was a counterpoint to that process. But if we think about the past 50, 60 years, generally there's been spectacular growth in the prices of shares of stock on the stock exchange in the United States and elsewhere.
Now, Piketty, you mentioned Thomas Piketty, Capital in the 21st Century, the blockbuster book from last year. And he's focused on the 1% and on the 1% of the 1%. I mean, he's talking about seriously rich people.
Yeah.
And they're going to be, regardless of their color, I would imagine there are not so many Black or Latino billionaires, if any. I don't know, but not so many. But if I'm asking about the political economy of wealth disparity, wouldn't I want to focus more so than on ethnic differences? You were criticizing him earlier about this. I guess I'm pushing back a little bit. Wouldn't I want to focus on people who have seriously large financial asset holdings and are in a position to be able to influence political process and so on?
So I'm not sure if you're making a strategic argument or you're making an argument that's somewhat different.
Okay, there would be a political argument about if I wanted to do a Bernie Sanders-like reform, then I go after the banks and I go after the fat cats.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm also making a kind of, if I want to understand the texture of the inequality, you make a good point about if I'm just barely on the line and the income is barely covering my expenses and I have nothing else to fall back on, my kid gets sick or something else happens, I'm in deep trouble. Somebody who's got a couple hundred thousand dollars cushion is not. But what I'm thinking about is, suppose I'm out here in Silicon Valley these days and I'm surrounded by entrepreneurs. Every cocktail party I go to, somebody has started a new business. Here's a venture capitalist over here. They're getting ready to raise $200 million for this. Here's somebody who just sold their business to.
If you go up the hill and do the dish walk, you'll be surrounded by folks who are in that position.
Yeah, they're out here. They're thick as thieves out here. I'm sorry for the metaphor, but that's like a different order of inequality altogether and seems to be worth looking into. I don't know that I'm disagreeing with anything that you've said. I'm just trying to emphasize how
I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be concerned
about
that.
Okay.
I'm saying that what's missing in much of the conversation or this discourse is attention being paid to the disparities that exist across racial and ethnic groups. I'm certainly personally, deeply concerned about what I might refer to as general inequality rather than intergroup inequality. But I think that intergroup inequality is part of what we must understand to have a full understanding of the way in which inequality has unfolded, particularly in the last century and the beginning of this one.
Okay. Now, do you want us to take away from this conversation in terms of understanding where the wealth disparity is coming from, the idea that most people who have wealth have it because they've inherited something from their parents?
Yes. And
can you quantify that?
I want to go beyond inheritance. Well, okay. Even in the studies that provide the most conservative estimates of the transfers across generations, they attribute approximately 15 to 20% of wealth accumulation to gifts and inheritances.
That's only 15 or 20%.
Out of the portion of the variation that's explained.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So okay. But I would argue, and this is something that we're working on now, is that those estimates are drawn from research that hasn't been done satisfactorily. And there are two kinds of issues that arise. One is frequently, and this is particularly true of, I don't want to condemn the sociologists, they're my best friends, but frequently what the sociologists do is they take an estimate of net worth and they regress it on various components of net worth, including gifts and inheritances. So essentially what they've done is they've estimated an accounting identity.
Yeah.
And of course that doesn't give you a causal analysis at
no.
all. So that's one of the ways in which these kinds of estimates have been generated. The other types of studies which have not done it that way have been plagued frequently by the classic endogeneity problem, where your outcome, your net worth, potentially is affecting some of the factors that you're treating as causal to the generation of the net worth. So
what would be an example of that?
Well, I guess the old Blau and Graham study, the one of the ones that actually has a very high estimate of the role of inheritances and gifts, is an example where they don't really correct for the possible simultaneous causation that's taking place. I mean, you typically have to work with longitudinal data sets. So the panel study of income dynamics might be the best one to use for this kind of study. And that's what we're attempting to work with now. The best study probably was the Wolf and Gittleman study that was conducted in the early 2000s. And we're in the process of trying to see if we can replicate it and improve it.
I see. But you said you want to go beyond bequest to have intergenerational effect.
I want to get to this category that we customarily call gifts or in vivo transfers, because I think that their effect is grossly underestimated. So if we think about situations where parents who have the resources provide their kids with some type of subsidy at a critical moment, that has great long-term implications which actually go beyond the measured amounts. So an example might be a young couple is getting married,
yeah,
and their parents help them with the down payment,
sure,
on a home,
right,
or young person going to college. I think most young people don't even think about the fact that if their parents are financing their college education, that's actually a transfer. I mean, most young people are just thinking, well, they're my parents, they love me, that's what they're supposed to do.
But you and I know that as parents, that those are real tens of thousands of dollars out the window.
They're quite substantial. Right. And to the extent that we're able,
yeah,
that we're lucky enough to have the resources to be able to help our kids, that's something that not all parents can do. And I think it makes a very significant difference in terms of the forks in the road points in people's lives. So a child might have a learning disability. And under some circumstances, that might be interpreted as the kid being mentally retarded.
Right.
But if the parents have sufficient resources to assist the kid,
yeah,
with developing methods for coping with that learning disability, it may turn out that the kid is absolutely brilliant, but no one would have known under conditions where it wasn't possible to determine that that's the appropriate diagnosis. So I think it's not just the amount of the transfer, but it's also the timing, which is very critical. And so that's something that we want to explore in greater depth.
That's interesting. Okay, so now I want to ask you about old-fashioned ideas like savings. I see you poo-pooing that, at least in terms of accounting for racial differences. You say they can save all they want, but they'll never catch up. But, you know, I was always taught coming up that, you know, you should put some money aside. Are there differences in the savings behavior by these various population groups? And does savings behavior have much at all to say about where wealth?
Okay. So first of all, the fact that something won't necessarily close the gap doesn't mean it's a bad thing to do.
Okay.
You know, I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't say, I think people should try to get as much education as possible. But I don't believe that getting as much education as possible will necessarily eliminate the racial wealth gap.
Okay, fair enough.
So that's the first. So, I'm in favor of the cookie jar at the beginning and learning how to engage in savings over the course of a lifetime. But, I mentioned the Wolf and Gittleman study.
Yeah.
The Wolf and Gittleman study indicated that actually at every level of income, blacks and whites actually have very similar savings rates, and that in fact in some income groupings, blacks have a slightly higher savings rate. So that would suggest to me that we can't explain racial differences in wealth accumulation on the basis of different behaviors around savings. A similar strong finding in their study, and this is one that we really want to reassess because I'm not positive that this is true, but their study found that rates of return on portfolios were roughly equivalent between blacks and whites, again, after you control for the income of the household.
Whoa.
Yeah, I mean that was a very startling finding.
You know, because I was going to ask you about financial.
But that's another reason we want to go back and look at the data.
Okay, you're not sure. I was going to ask about financial literacy issues and whether they, you know, people maybe being more or less familiar with investment vehicles and how to be able to get the highest return on their savings. But it sounds like that's not really an issue according to the study that you just cited.
Right. I mean, if anything, if we were to take Wolf and Gittleman seriously, we'd just have to argue that everybody is financially illiterate.
Yeah.
And you know, actually, that's facetious, but there is a serious point there. I mean, if you think about it, the people who Bernie Madoff defrauded are certainly not people that we would think of as being financially illiterate.
Right.
And so, I think in some sense, we're all vulnerable to ignorance about how the financial markets work.
Well, in fact, they thought that they were cleverer than the next guy because they had the great opportunity to invest in this amazing fund that was generating 15, 20% a year.
Right.
They were standing in line to put their money into
Ponzi scheme. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
But now, what about business formation, entrepreneurship and whatever? Again, correct me if I'm wrong. I have the impression that some groups, let me say Jewish Americans, who are many, perhaps most, descended from relatively poor immigrants from Eastern Europe and so forth, over the course of the 20th century become amongst the wealthiest of the ethnically identifiable populations in the country. If they descend from poor immigrants, they couldn't have gotten that way by their fathers or grandfathers handing over to them. So where did their wealth come from, giving Jewish Americans only as an example of the more general point that I'm trying to make, which is wealth creation? Okay, not just wealth holding, but wealth creation, engaging in the activities that end up creating a successful business or whatever it might be that allows for the wealth to come into existence in the first place.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I'm not sure my answer will be convincing, but I'm going to give it a shot. I think that there are actually different phases of opportunity that have existed in the U.S. economy, that there was a period in which social mobility was much greater than it is now. And I would argue that coincides heavily with the period of immigration of Eastern and Southern Europeans. I think that we have to be a bit careful in terms of how we examine the history of Jewish immigrants to the United States, because there was an earlier phase of immigration of Sephardic Jews who actually come into the United States with relatively high degrees of wealth because they initially go to the Caribbean and then migrate northward to the United States. And in the Caribbean, they were engaged like other white immigrants in the maintenance of the slave plantation system. And that was a source of a significant amount of wealth for them. So that when the Ashkenazim immigrate to the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century, there is already a Jewish presence in the United States of individuals who actually were relatively wealthy. In fact, the label that was applied to them was the grandees. So even though there was tension between the two groups, the Sephardic community actually did provide support for the new immigrants. And so that, I think, made a difference in terms of their longer-term outcomes. But the other thing that's interesting about the Ashkenazic immigrants is that they were highly literate in their languages of origin. Unlike the Southern European immigrants, they were trained as artisans, but had been driven out of those positions because of anti-Semitism, particularly in Russia. Relatively more urbanized. So they're very different from the other immigrant communities.
Let me just say something on the side here, Sandy.
Yeah.
I remember Thomas Sowell making these kind of arguments, the ones that you're making right now, 40, 45 years ago.
But he made the argument on the basis of a claim that there was something culturally special.
Indeed he did. Indeed he did.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that. That's not, you know, I rarely invoke the term culture at all. So I'm steering clear of that. But I am, you know, if you wanted to use the simple language of human capital, I would agree that there was a community of immigrants that came from Eastern Europe that actually had relatively high levels of human capital, even though they had low levels of income.
Okay, let me, on this culture point, just push back for a minute. You don't think there's anything to the idea that some identifiable ethnic national origin groups are more entrepreneurial than others?
No,
I don't. Have a greater, you know, a nose for business or things like that?
No, I don't buy that.
Because if we see all the green grocers being Koreans in the inner city green grocery markets, if we see all the laundries being Chinese, and if we see all the motels being South Asians, Pakistanis, and Indians, you see what I'm getting at.
The groups with the highest level of entrepreneurship are also the groups with the highest presence of recent immigrants. So immigrant communities are disproportionately engaged in self-employment. And so if you observe a particular ethnic or racial group that has very, very high rates of entrepreneurship, it is probably in part or significantly in part because that is a population that has a relatively high presence of recent immigrants. But the other dimension of this, and this gets us back to wealth, is that the capacity to undertake new businesses is heavily affected by your access to wealth. And, you know, if we think about the Koreans come into the United States, or they did, with approximately $120,000 to $150,000 in net worth.
Yeah.
So the strata of immigrants from Korea was actually a very, very a relatively well-off community. And so, so they were denied the opportunity to use their advanced educational credentials to take positions that were commensurate with that, and so they turned to self-employment. But, you know, they couldn't have done that as effectively if they hadn't already come in with a certain foundation or basis in an initial level of wealth. So the real puzzle is those groups who have had high levels of success in starting up businesses and maintaining them, because many of these small businesses don't last very long, and maintaining them without starting with a significant wealth foundation in the first place. And I'm not sure who those groups are necessarily. That, you know, I mean, that would be a very interesting community to examine closely.
Okay, that's a good answer. We're kind of getting up against the time here, and I wanted to give you a chance to talk about how you think public policy ought to respond to the problems that you and your colleagues have been identifying in your empirical research.
Well, I said earlier that even though I'm very, very engaged in thinking about intergroup disparities with respect to wealth, when you move me to the policy level, there is a proposal that I've been advocating, which is actually a universal proposal. And that is something that we call the baby bonds proposal, so dubbed by the late Manning Marable, which is not really a bond. It's the provision of a trust fund or an endowment to each newborn infant. And in the proposal that Derek Hamilton and I have been talking about, that endowment would be graduated on the basis of the wealth position of the child's family. So, you know, in the stump speech, I say if we were to give an endowment to a newborn child for Oprah Winfrey or for Bill Gates, we'd give them $50. But for kids who are born into families at the lower end of the wealth distribution, we'd give them an endowment of $50,000 to $60,000. And we would guarantee a 1% real rate of interest on the account, and the kids could access them when they become 18 years of age.
Regardless of whether they had gotten in trouble with the law or anything of that sort?
They could access it when they become 18 years of age.
That's their money?
If we wanted to put restrictions on what they could do with it, I don't object to that since it's public funds. But in my most non-paternalistic moments, I say just give them the lump sum and let them do with it as they please. But
okay, yeah. I just want to underscore what's really a revolutionary proposal, it strikes me.
Really?
Every American, I don't know what we're going to do about immigrants. I'll get to that. I mean, I'll let you tell me about that.
Every
American at birth is entitled to some wealth. Everybody's going to have some.
Everybody's going to have some.
I want to know how we're going to pay for this, but I can imagine we're going to tax somebody somewhere along the line to try to generate these funds, and I'm okay with that. And they're going to know they've got it.
Right.
You know, they know that when they mature, when they, that can be the down payment on their little apartment. That can be what they use to supplement their college going fund. That can be used to start up a business. That can be their nest egg.
And we could have a reasonable basis for giving them financial literacy courses because they would be sure to have something that they would have to manage.
They've got a piece of the rock. They've got a stake in the system. Where's the money going to come from?
So if we estimate that there's about 4 million newborn infants in a given year, and if we could go higher, it's not going to make much difference in terms of these numbers. But if there are 4 million infants born in a given year, and the mean amount of the payment to each child was $20,000, that would be $80 billion per annum. And since there's a gestation period of 18 years before you have to make the first payouts, then we could set up a trust fund to fund the trust. And the annual expense really is, I mean, $80 billion is not much of an expense in terms of the U.S. budget.
Over a 20 or 18 year period or whatever. We're not grandfathering in anybody. Nobody who's 12 years old is going to get anything.
No. So it's the luck of the draw in terms of when you were born here. But
So you're saying general revenues, or you wouldn't have a wealth tax or something like that?
We could have a wealth tax, but I think you could set up this program without it. I'm kind of intrigued by proposals that undertake the idea of redistribution without confiscation.
For political reasons?
In some measure for political reasons, but I guess, but the other piece of it is I'm less concerned about people having a whole lot than people not having enough. And I was at a meeting once and somebody leaned over to me after listening to me grumble a bit and said, You know, the problem with you, Darity, is you think that there's too many rich people. And I said, no, I don't think there's enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You wouldn't mind being one yourself, or?
I wouldn't mind being one myself, but I'd also like lots of other people to be rich.
So where are you on the so-called death tax, on the estate tax? Do you have a position?
I don't have a strong position. I'm certainly okay with taxing large fortunes, but I don't think that's as important as ensuring that we give additional resources to folks who have very little.
I remember you having been a big advocate of reparations to African Americans for slavery and Jim Crow discrimination. Do you still hold that position, and how does that dovetail with your work on wealth?
So I do hold to that position, but I think it's that this is a set of steps that one takes because of the historic treatment of blacks in the United States. I think that the baby bonds proposal could go a long way towards addressing wealth inequality by race de facto because of the relative position of blacks. If we have a plan where we give more to those who have the least in the way of wealth, blacks are disproportionately concentrated in that set of the population. So it's a universal program that would have a particular benefit for blacks. So you wouldn't necessarily have to have a race-specific program like reparations to address racial wealth inequality.
You mean,
but I think reparations is something that ought to take place, but I think so it's primarily because of the need to address the historic injustices that have taken place in this country.
Well, now's not the time for you and I to undertake a debate on that. We should probably do another program on that one. But I hear you saying that if your baby bonds proposal were to be enacted, that would take a little bit of the pressure off in terms of redressing some of the concerns that motivate you to advocate for racial reparations.
Yeah, if it was an effective program and there were substantial payments given to the children whose families have very low net worth, I think it would take some of the pressure off.
Okay, well, William A. Darity Jr., thank you very much for coming on the Glenn Show. We learned a lot, and we should do it again sometime.
Thanks, Glenn. Okay. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.